Good evening to all of you. I had planned a different type of lecture. You know, every year when somebody gets a Nobel Prize, or a group gets, I give a lecture on that topic, which I have been doing for the last several years here. But this year I wanted to give a lecture on black holes and on, Hawking, basically. But then over the last 1 month, I changed my plan, essentially because of three reasons. One is, there was a note from the director that the faculty members of the institute should give a 10-year plan of what they want to do. I liked that very much, and that set me thinking about planning, because it's something in which I have also been involved earlier with our own institution at Bombay and also with other institutions. And then the other thing that happened was there was a book which came. The name of the book is, the title of the book is Lost in Math. This book is by a lady who is a string theorist, a particle physicist, a string theorist. She spent 20 years doing string theory. And she was very frustrated because nothing really worthwhile has come out of the string theory. So what she did was, she went around and interviewed all the other string theorists in the world to find out how they are feeling. And some of them very senior people who started string theory and all. And the review of the book came, and that book was quite clear that some of the, Professor Cesaro and myself have been talking for the last 1 year about how unsatisfactory much of the recent research is, where it is not leading us to something very fundamental. So then I got the book. Fortunately, it was available, and I went through the book. So many of the ideas I'm going to talk in this is connected with long-term planning. You see, what has happened is that the scientific research has gone into a stage where 30, 40 years is the normal period to get final results. See, in our own experience, you know, when I was director of TIR for 30 years ago, we started building this big radio telescope in Pune area. Of course, after 10 years it was built. It was one of the most expensive instruments built in our country. But for the last 20 years, they have got a lot of good results. But only just a month ago, they got a very fundamental result. They have been able to discover a radio galaxy which is so far away, the most distant radio galaxy which anybody has recorded, which means because it is so distant, it is one of the youngest formed radio galaxy. So now that we know the position of that galaxy, lot more will be done, and we will know the physics of that period. That means, see, we are after something like 10.7 billion years from the date of birth of the universe, if you agree to that time. But this happens, the physics of this particular one takes you back to less than a million years, to less than 10 million years. So it's very important because there is so much of speculation about the conditions of the Big Bang theory, which I'll talk a little also. So these things changed me and said that I should talk about how it takes time to plan things, and what is most important is planning. And planning has got three aspects. One is the scientific aspect or whatever field in which you're investigating. The other is the resource aspect for that planning. And third one is manpower. You know, this, when I come to that, I'll explain. There is a particle called the Higgs boson, the discovery of which, experimental discovery, got a Nobel Prize for Professor Higgs, who is still alive. But the Higgs was proposed in 1970s. So you can imagine, one has to wait for long periods for the real fructification of their ideas. Now the question is whether that's the only method or whether one has to find other methods. So this brings in the whole question of scientific methodology. The scientific methodology that we have been following is laid out right from the time of Newton. And it starts like this, that you start first some observation or experiment, and then you try to collect more data from the experiment, and then you try to systematize it, make many observations, and then you do a theory on that. And after the theory, you try to formulate it mathematically. And on the basis of mathematics, you make predictions. And the predictions have to be verified. This is, in short, the whole methodology of science. And that is what we have all followed all these years. And this methodology was very successful in earlier times, Newtonian dynamics, in electricity and magnetism, acoustics, optics, and also helpful in explaining most phenomena encountered in everyday life, and was based on concepts which are common sense concepts, space, time, matter, energy, etc. So much of the science that was developed was not based on exotic concepts which you can't understand. That's what happens as you come to later sciences, you find the concepts themselves we don't understand. And but up to the beginning of 20th century, this classical physics, as we talk about, was very effective and explained many things. But then around that time, there was a breakdown. See, a lot of new theories, new experiments revealed, that among which, you know, the famous ones are radioactivity was discovered. We couldn't explain how spontaneous emission takes place from radioactive material. There was no theory for that. And then, let me tell you, even now there is no theory. I mean, some have remained like that. You see, we talk so much about success in science. We don't have a proper theory. We have, we can only calculate. We can't say in which direction a radioactive particle is emitted. We can't say when it is going to be emitted. With all our theories, if one radioactive particle is emitted now in a particular direction, the next one, where it will go, at what time it will be emitted, we don't. We just, I mean, the theoretical situation is such, we can't predict it. It's not possible. So there are problems which have remained. Radioactivity was discovered, as you know, in the beginning of last century. Even after 120 years, we have not been able to. There are problems like that. Then, you see, sometimes, by luck, you know, the old experiments of Faraday and Oersted, which led to electric field concept and magnetic field concept, that was worked into the famous electromagnetic theory. And the electromagnetic theory was a great revolution in terms of, you know, both giving ideas of propagation of waves and then identifying electromagnetic wave with the light, what till then was thought to be right from the time of Newton, considered to be just particles, but we don't know what those particles were. But then the light particles and the electromagnetic waves were the same, because a very curious coincidence that the velocity of light and the calculated velocity of the electromagnetic waves were identical. So the measured velocity of light and the calculated velocity of electromagnetic waves. So Maxwell made the bold assumption that light is an electromagnetic wave. From there started the new way of thinking. There actually your logic doesn't play a role. It is purely a coincidence and a bold hypothesis that light is an electromagnetic wave. There is no way of proving that actually. Of course, then started the discoveries, radioactivity, proton, electron, and X-ray. All these, there was no explanation how they took place. Therefore, entirely two new theories came into existence: the quantum mechanics, quantum theory, and then the special theory of relativity by Einstein. And these theories helped us to explain many things. For example, one very anomalous feature at that time, which was not explained, was just discrete spectral lines. You see, some elements, when you heated them, they were emitting. Hydrogen would give a beautiful spectral line, and that would somehow give an identity of that particular element. So the relation between the particular elements and then the spectral lines was a big problem. This was used by the chemists for identifying, but there was no explanation how, and that is where Bohr's theory of quantum, Bohr's theory of the atom, helped a lot. Then around the same time, a mysterious particle started appearing in at ground level, which would discharge. If you charge up a sphere and leave it there, it would be discharged after about a few minutes, a few seconds, depending upon the size. Now the question was, how was it discharged? And this led to the discovery that it's a very enormously implicated affair, that there's a mysterious particle that is coming into the Earth. And this pursuit of this particular study at various altitudes led to the discovery that this mysterious radiation is coming from somewhere in the universe. It is extrasolar, coming from somewhere in the universe. And as more and more investigations went on, it was full of very high energy particles, not ordinary energies which you could produce in any of the accelerators at that time. Why? So this became an important area. Not only that, these particles interacted with the atmosphere and they produced lot more new particles. And as time went on, you see, one realized that we live in a universe that is filled up not only with matter of the time that we are familiar just outside our houses, but with various different kinds of particles. Some of the particles, the cosmic ray particles, called the mesons, which were produced in these high energy interactions, lived for exceedingly short intervals of time. So the whole emphasis in research shifted to finding out the new particles and their properties, because these were all, most of them, charged particles, and then they lived only for a short time, but they lived enough long because of a very different reason. That is, when Einstein started his special theory of relativity, he first had to face one problem, serious problem, that was the velocity of light was a constant, irrespective of whether you are moving in a, you are stationary or you are moving in a vehicle. Wherever you go, the velocity was not, I have not pressed it there. Okay, leave it there. I'll do it. So the velocity of light was a constant, which violated whatever we knew about movement of particles. If two cars are moving in opposite direction, if one is going faster, you approach the other one earlier than if because of light velocity is the same, irrespective of whether you are moving in the forward direction or backward direction, velocity of light remains the same. What changes is the color of the light will change. So this became a very important clue to the whole field of astronomy, that many objects whose distance we did not know, you see, we could determine on the basis of the simple relation between light and the change in the velocity, in the color of light, the wavelength of light. So that gave a handle on the distance of the object. Now this situation, once we started finding out the distance of stars and distance of wherever light is coming from, you see, completely changed our ideas of the universe. We originally, the universe consisted of only what we could see with our eyes, a few stars and planets and their motions and eclipses and things like that. But with the installation of two large telescopes in California in the early part of last century, changed the whole thing. We started realizing that patches of light which are seen in small telescopes were actually galaxies, and each galaxy contained billions of stars. That is the wonder. So, and then there are billions of galaxies, patches of light. So the whole concept of the universe completely changed, that we have objects. And then the velocity of light helped us to shift in the wavelength, helped us to gauge what the distances are. And then it was fantastic that the distances are enormous. The size of the universe, which we thought was so small like that, became enormously bigger. But then one other thing was noticed with the 100-inch and 200-inch telescopes, that was, these galaxies are not at rest. They are, see, even in 1915, Einstein proposed his special general theory of relativity. These objects of the entire sky, he thought, were all at rest. But what the Hubble telescopes showed, this was by, not Hubble telescope, but by Hubble, the 100-inch and 200-inch, showed was very peculiar, that the galaxies are running away from each other at fantastic speeds. So the concept of the universe as an expanding universe with and then he found another factor which was not expected at all, that is, the larger the separation between two galaxies, the faster they are moving away. So this gave to an entirely new concept of the universe, that we are living in a universe which is very big and it is continuously expanding and becoming more and more big each day, each minute it's becoming kind of everything. So this led to this finding out that the galaxies are moving away from each other faster, the greater the distance, gave rise to the idea, it is possible at some point of time in the past, all the entire universe was together. So this gave some clue as to how the universe could have been created. By then, see, when this happened somewhere in, the expansion of the universe was seen around 1930s, and then the theory was built that all the entire matter in the universe was together at some point And that turned out to be, with the velocities that they had measured, about 13.6 billion years. Right? So 13.6 billion years ago, if the entire universe was together, you can imagine what could have been the density of matter at that time. See, such an enormous... on that Earth, the heaviest density is tantalum, which is about 22 grams per cc years. Now, this material would be billions of tons per cc, the material we start with. And the point is, if it's an expanding universe, when you contract it, you have to reach a stage where it becomes infinite density. So theoretically, this idea of a singularity came up with a big problem, because if how can you put so much matter in such small amount of space? You know? So this is where Einstein again talked about a parameter. He, in general theory of relativity, he talked about a parameter called lambda, which is at very great densities. In addition to the attractive force, there will be a repulsive force. The lambda force is a repulsive force. And a lot of discussion has taken place about this idea of singularity. And if you go through the astrophysics journals and articles, etc., you find how can you have such infinite density areas, and from where all that energy will come. If you say, yes, all right, there is infinite energy density here, from where did that energy come? Another big question mark, which we have no answer as yet. But then, in parallel, the whole field of particle physics developed, starting with cosmic rays and the fact that particles decay from one to the other. They are not stable particles. They decay from pi mesons, become mu mesons become neutrinos, etc. That entire high energy field became an extremely important new area, and that started throwing light on the various aspects of the universe. But a serious problem came. The universe does not consist only of matter, but the enormous amount of other radiations are there. So, the idea of what are the various types of radiations that are there in the universe, because somewhere in the 1950s, they found that the universe is filled with radio waves of a millimeter wavelength radio waves, called 3-degree radiation, that corresponds to a temperature of 3-degree black body. The entire universe is filled with that, and everywhere, wherever you go in the universe, you will find, in addition to matter, invariably you will find the radio radiation. Then came, you see, along with radio astronomy, which had started developing, of course, this 3-degree radiation was found to be exceedingly isotropic in every direction it was there. Wherever you go, it was there. Density was the same. But then the interest was, is it really isotropic? Is it really, to what level of isotropy we can? Then very clever and very large experiments were done with satellites to establish the uniformity of the 3-degree radiation. They were finding it was uniform to the extent of 10 to the power of minus 5. But beyond that, the uniformity was questionable. Because that was required. If something started creating, and if you have got galaxies, stars, etc., the discreteness has to come. And at some stage or the other, when the universe is being created. So in the reverse, they started thinking about that. They wanted something like 10 to the power of minus 6 or so in the non-uniformity of the, and that was for the 3-degree radiation. That became a very important clue to the idea that the universe is created by an explosion at some earlier point of time. Though there were still various serious problems, as I said, about singularity and things like that. Then started an entirely new type of investigations, because by then technology developed. It became possible to put satellites, and satellites, on the satellites you could put any type of instrumentation that you want. So it became with high altitude balloons and satellites and rockets, new types of investigations started. And one started seeing that we are getting information from the various objects in the sky, not only in the form of light, but quite a lot more in the form of X-rays, in the form of gamma rays, and of course cosmic ray particles were already known. So the universe became more complicated, and then investigations started showing that there are not only light sources, but there are X-ray sources, there are gamma ray sources. That means some of the objects are emitting X-rays, some of them are in huge quantities. And they once started identifying the X-ray stars, the gamma ray stars, etc. The concept of the universe became much more complicated than what one had thought. So now the background in the universe consists not only of the 3-degree radiation, but all the X-rays and all the gamma rays that are produced in the various objects. This area, line of investigation, led to some very interesting new objects, what are called pulsars. The pulsars are actually stars around which another object, or the same star, is rotating, and if matter falls on that, it emits radiation. And they found that radiation of repetitive radiations called pulsars was seen in the radio first. So there became radio pulsars. Then they found X-ray pulsars, gamma ray pulsars. This was very important, because I'm sure most of you know about what Chandrasekhar did when he was still had just completed his education in India and was traveling on the ship. Just then quantum mechanics ideas had come, and he was trying to understand. There is one important principle which quantum mechanics, which Pauli had propagated, that is that there is a very important parameter called the exclusion principle, which is very important in the stability of matter. And Chandrasekhar was calculating what mass a star can have to be stable. Otherwise, they should just disperse. Why is it that they get together, and when a star explodes, what happens? These are the questions that he started. And then it became, through his quantum mechanical calculations, it became clear that if the sun mass, so solar mass stars are quite stable, they will take a long time to disintegrate. But stars of much higher mass, if you look at, then they only have a shorter lifetime. So the lifetime of most of the objects in the sky would not be that very long, excepting the light stars. All the others will break away. And if you take a heavier and heavier mass star, what happens? We go beyond what is called the Chandrasekhar limit. Then some very peculiar things his calculations show, that the star will explode when all the radiation material is gone, all the elements are gone, you are left with an object which has only gravitation pull left, and that you cannot help that object contracting. And that led to the idea that there could be objects like neutron stars, which are made only of neutrons, which are a result of this collapse of heavy mass stars. Then came the question, where does it stop if the collapse starts taking place? Where does it stop? Then if the mass is small, not above the mass of the sun, but within a couple of masses of the solar, then it will stop at the neutron star level. But if you start with a still higher mass star, then it will become a black hole. It condenses and condenses. Ultimately, you reach a stage where it will become a black hole. So you can see that all kinds of new theories came, search for new objects started, and at the same time, some of these we had to depend upon quantum mechanical calculations. So, and in quantum mechanical calculation, there are serious problems there itself. In fact, one could not understand the what is called the collapse of the wave. Even till today, one has no proper solution to the problem of the collapse of the wave function. So what has happened now today, to come to the topic of the lecture, you see, on the one hand, we have come to a situation where very strange thing has been found about the universe. This is very recent, in the last 15 years or so, I would say. We find that whatever we have been talking about till today, the universe, only 5% of the energy of that universe, we know in what form it is, what we call normal matter, consisting of electrons, protons. The 95% of the energy of the universe, we don't know what they are. Therefore, that 95% is what we call dark energy. And among them, there is also a contribution from dark particles. See, around each galaxy, for the galaxy to be stable, there has to be a lot of dark matter. They have not been able to identify what that dark matter is. Lot of research is going on to identify the dark matter and dark energy. This is the kind of... And what is staggering is the quantity of that. You see, the point is that it exceeds, it's 95% we don't know, completely ignorant, and 5% only we have. But this 5% itself tells you that 95% must be there, but we don't know what it is. So the dark energy and dark matter is one of the biggest problems that... Now, this dark energy, at least some people believe, is nothing other than what Einstein thought of as the lambda. See, he introduced a parameter which in his equations, which gave the result that you could have an expansion of the universe, the reverse to gravitational force. So that lambda, some people at least think, could be the reason for this dark energy. But there is a big problem coming there. That is, the what is required and what the theory predicts is in order of magnitude 10 to the power of 20 different. So there's a huge difference between what the theory says and what experimentally one finds. This is the main thing that I wanted to emphasize, that today the crisis is because Higgs boson has been discovered. And that's really a very creditable discovery. But it has costed the world something like 10 to 15 billion dollars. The effort of more than 1,000 scientists and technologists. And then from all over, the experiment is done at CERN, but most of the instruments, India also has contributed to the building up of this new accelerator, LHC. So it was predicted 30 years back. Now you come to the situation where it is detected, but it has posed a big problem because the same theory requires that within the energy range of the LHC, which detected the Higgs boson, there must be other particles. Otherwise, the theory breaks down completely. And this is because they have been predicting that corresponding, one other thing that happened early in the game of particle physics was that the particles fall into two classes in terms of statistical distributions called fermions and bosons. The statistics of bosons and statistics followed by fermions, that means electrons, protons, the integrally charged particles and half integrally charged particles. And not half integrally charged, half integrally spin particles. Is very different. So the one does not know why the universe is divided into bosons and divided into fermions. Because I don't have time to describe, as we went down in the reductionistic method, we came to protons and neutrons, etc. And from there, we further went down to quarks. And the quarks are fractionally charged particles, but their spin is half integral. Whereas the forces which bind them together, the gluons, and then the photons and things like that, they are all bosons. The statistics of these two are different. So the theories were built up around this question of what statistics these bosons and hadrons follow. And the problem with Higgs boson now is Higgs has to be a boson according to the theory. But if that is a boson and if the value of the mass of Higgs is 1.25 trillion electron volts, they find the same accelerator should give rise to a large number of what are called supersymmetric particles. Corresponding to an electron, there should be a selectron. Corresponding to a proton, there should be a proton. Like this, he can. So there should be, corresponding to every particle that obeys the normal statistics, Fermi statistics, there should be a particle which obeys the other statistics. That is, boson statistic. There is so far absolutely no evidence for the SUSY particles. All these days they were saying, we don't know the mass of the Higgs, and theoretically there is somehow a close connection between the Higgs boson and the mass of the SUSY particle, corresponding SUSY particle. That is determined. That is well fixed. So now that they have found the mass of they know at what energy they should expect the SUSY particles to turn up. All these days, the other accelerators, they were taking escape by the fact that the energy is not enough to produce Higgs particles, so SUSY may be still higher energy particles. But today, there is no such excuse. So there is a big anomaly there as to why the SUSY particles are not seen. Supersymmetric particles corresponding to all the normal particles still not seen. This we don't understand. See, there are so many other results like that. Problem between theory and experiment. As I told you, we don't understand what the dark matter is, walk the talk and I'm doing this, etc. So some of these people have raised the question whether there is some problem with our method of scientific method itself. Because so far we have followed, and then up to now the scientific methodology has worked. But whether we have come to a stage where we are seeing the limitations of the methodology itself. Some people are seriously thinking about that, whether there is a need to rethink about the scientific methodology itself. That's the message I wanted to convey in this talk, that while planning, you see, the whole point is that if you want to look at the future at any institution, at any kind of the question that arises is what kind of research we should be doing, and then what is the money that is required for that research. This is very important because we have to learn a lesson from the Chinese. See, silently, let me tell you, in all these areas, we were not seeing, particularly the experimental areas, contribution from China. But now it turns out that we come to know, and of course, not that they had kept all this secretive, but the magnitude of effort that was going on, and the kind of emphasis they were putting on training people and on spending money, is so remarkable that there is a radio dish which is similar to the Arecibo dish in the United States, which broke down a few years back. I don't know whether it has been repaired or not. But that is not a regular metallic dish, but it's a cutting in the ground, a parabolic shape of thing. That was about 300 feet diameter or so. The Chinese have made a 500 feet diameter radio dish, and they're collecting information. And Chinese have made deep underground laboratories for the study of these neutrinos. In fact, I don't have time to go into neutrinos, because neutrino is going to be the next this present century's main emphasis. Both certain people also are trying to do. Now what we are trying to do is, the neutrino, for a long time they were dependent on what you can get from cosmic rays. But now the new idea is, you use the accelerator and then bombard the Earth. And then in that process, you can produce most of these particles which decay into neutrinos. And they are able to make it highly directional. So now deep underground laboratories have come in the United States and also in Canada, where they are looking at these neutrino beams. And these neutrinos have very peculiar properties. You know, they are what are called electron neutrinos and muon neutrinos. You see, when they travel from the Sun to the Earth, they were actually getting transformed from one to the other. You see, there was alteration of their identity during the passage of. So by the time it strikes, the neutrino from the Sun strikes the Earth, see, it could be one type or the other. That is why for a long time there was what's called the solar neutrino puzzle, which was solved by this kind of phenomenon, that they were transforming into each other. But they are doing now to find out. You see, I didn't project that. There is what is called the standard model picture, in which first there was electron neutrino, and there was a muon neutrino, there was a tau meson neutrino. But now they are suspecting, because of certain violations, that there could be neutrinos of other flavors. So they want to detect those neutrinos of other flavor. All these are getting ready. They use the accelerators to send directed beams of neutrinos, and the detectors of neutrinos may be hundreds of miles away, actually, on the other side. The Chinese have done already this kind of work. Underground. So the planning, depending upon what scale of operation you get involved, has to be done very carefully. See, in some of the areas, the planning has to be for 30, 40 years. I mean, see, even these accelerators like Fabry accelerator and the latest LHC accelerator, these have taken 10 to 15 years of construction and billions of dollars. So the question is, how do we plan? Should we enter into these areas? One area is that you do collaboration with them, you do part of the experimentation, part of the, you agree to build, as we have been doing, the apparatus here, or magnets here. But what is the credit you get for that? Say, when Higgs boson was discovered, only three people got, I think two people got the Nobel Prize for it. And the other 1,000 people who participated in that, in fact, there are 1,000 names, I think, on the name of the publication. There are 1,000 names also. So what is the credit they get for so much of effort? So you have got to evaluate the credit of people in a very different way if you get involved in these big projects. The involvement in big projects is not a solution which is always so then you have to think in terms of small experiments. That requires much greater, because with the power of technology and with the kind of for every one scientist in India, people used to ask me earlier, why India is not getting Nobel Prizes? I said, for every one competent scientist at that level in India, there are 10 people in the United States, there are 10 people, the level of people have highly competent people are required. So, actually I would like to have the ideas of some people here about planning, whether how should we proceed in India for the future. Because, for me it's only an academic exercise, but for most people it is a very important center. Questions and any ideas?
Would you like to sit and answer?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Talk and fascinating expose you have made, but it is also, it leaves you with a lot of dissonance, doesn't it?
I didn't follow your question.
If I understood right, it's very complicated and not so easy to understand. But what you are saying is really a breakdown of methodology of science, and that is very disconcerting, because we have taken science to be valid. So something objectively valid. So it's really difficult to accept this philosophically because of the mayhem this causes overall. And is it, obviously there's a lot of ignorance one can't understand, but is it that it is the methodology of theorizing that has broken down? See, science is ultimately only a method, no? Scientific method. And it's difficult to conceive of an alternative to it. I mean, there are alternative ways of approaching knowledge, but I don't know how I can explain, but it is, see, it's not objectivity in observation was lost already, quantum mechanics, uncertainty principle and all that, subjectivity. But objectively not. So, when you say methodology written down, it's a little, lot of dissonance, and I really don't know what you'll say. But the other thing that comes to mind when you say it's so complex, it, what it shows is that our world, our universe is so complex that see, with advancing knowledge, we have reached those complexities which are very difficult now to comprehend. And therefore, but this is then a, would you say this is a problem peculiar to physics and astrophysics?
Methodology. That's why I listed right in the beginning what is the scientific methodology. But you know that even Einstein, he was what you call a positivist. He believed in experimental, you know, you have to solve the problem finally to the satisfaction of everybody through experiments. It happened in his case quite a lot. But he came, he makes a very important statement that the he believes that the final reality, whatever it is, can come out of the brain, mathematical. See, the truth of anything finally is in mathematics. So he believed that the mathematical equations and solutions of mathematical equations, you see, give you a method of reality, what is really kind of thing. It's a very difficult to understand because you cannot, see, for us, for example, Higgs boson was, why was it brought in? To give mass to various particles. But the mass to various particles, it doesn't give in the sense that we want it because immediately it asks for the coupling constant. And the coupling constant for the interaction between one particle and the other, Higgs particle and say electron, you don't know. They cannot, theoretically you cannot do that. So what do? You say we depend upon experiment. So the same thing even Newton did. You see, Newton, inverse square law which he used for gravity, the verification had to come only after he assumed in some cases what the coupling constant is, what the constant of G, M1 by R squared, you know, M1, M2 by R squared. But G is important, gravitational constant is important, and no theory can tell you what the gravitational constant is. But what is important is was he said that it is the same for the entire universe, wherever you go. Whatever we, if there are two masses of particles, then the same G operates. Why? One doesn't know. But he cannot give a theoretical answer to what G should be. The same thing has continued. That is one of the problems with scientific methodology. You cannot be independent of the experiment. So the question is, the when he says that you can do it by mathematical thing, what does he mean by it? Does it mean the intuition? Does it, what exactly he means, we are not able to figure out.
Any other questions?
If scientific method has come to a sort of a dead end, what is the alternative?
Please repeat.
If scientific method has come to a dead end at this stage, when we are probing into more and more subatomic particles and unable to explain dark matter and so on, if scientific method has come to a dead end at this stage, what is the alternative?
It's a difficult question to answer, actually, because, you know, planning for science, what should be the way we go about, is something which needs a proper discussion with people who are alive with these difficulties. You see, in fact, if you go to some of these international conferences, you find that hardly one or two people come out with something which is really, exciting and which has got full of ideas, etc. Otherwise, most of the work that is being done everywhere is just, experimental work of a certain kind, get more data, and then now there is a philosophy which is many people are warning against that you can do everything if you have got data, which is not correct, because yes, data is required, data analysis is required, but whether without intuition you can deal with the data in any meaningful way, that's a very important aspect. So secondly, the reliability of data is very important, actually, whether so the methodology, when I said, has to be changed, one has to seriously think where it is possible. Whether is it the mathematical methodology that we are going wrong, or is it, why is it that these predictions, you see, we have no idea, as I told you, we have no idea of such a large amount of energy being there, but we don't know its identity. We have not even an idea of in what form it is. So doesn't it become a very big question mark as to our methodology if we are not able to answer a question as to the identity of such a large... See, you have to talk a little louder because my ear is not so...
Sir, how do you plan and fund mathematical work, which is what you recommend that we do? How do you plan and fund mathematical work or mathematical effort?
Mathematical, yes. Plan, fund, funding.
That is what you recommend.
No, that's a, I'll tell you, one of the reasons why India has not been able to make that kind of a front-ranking research is essentially inadequate funding. See, in my experience, I have spent a lot of time in the Kolar gold fields deep underground. We got the first results on many things, but we could not pursue it because of lack of funds. Even TIFR, where I work, you see, was probably one of the best funded institutions in the country. But it was short by a factor of 10 to 20. If we had a factor of 10 in our Kolar Goldfield experiments, we would have done much more than what we did. See, funding is a very serious problem and cannot be underestimated. Funding is required. See, and the other is manpower. See, manpower, we are able to train people. I mean, if you have got funds, we can certainly get manpower. We can train manpower over a period of a few years. But funds are very important. And somehow, see, that's where I brought in the idea of China. See, China is able to spend, and China's economy is not any much greater than Indian economy. Their emphasis is probably different.
You were mentioning about planning the future experiments, work and all. So what do you think the future for Indian science in these areas? Because the experiments are highly capital intensive. you need huge amount of funding. Like you said, the CERN, some other activities. It is only international agencies like that can invest that type of money, instruments, computing and all that. So is it that the only option for Indian science is to get into collaboration mode with international agencies? Because we cannot aspire to set up the huge experimental facilities. So see, what do you foresee as the future of Indian science in this?
There I would like to suggest what Bhava was telling us all the time, that don't get into areas where you have serious competition. You get into areas where you can, with whatever resources you have, you can do first-rate work. That is the, that's how, you know, radio astronomy, building a telescope in Ooty, down a slope of 7 degrees, is very different from building a similar telescope at 40 degrees, or engineering-wise, just impossible. Nobody else can compete with you, only equatorial latitude people. And there was nobody competing with us at equatorial latitude. So that paid off. The whole point is you have got to think, and same thing happened with KGF at that point of time. But later on what happened was others, you see, by sheer money power, they built huge. See, Japanese, you know, used a lot of money on type of experiments which we did in KGF and got Nobel Prizes. So we have to, in India, we have to do two things. Firstly, we have to find more money. Secondly, we have to think of problems which is not that expensive, where we can build up expertise, both in theory and experiment. But going into fashionable areas is not the solution.
Anybody else? Yeah.
Sorry to come back again. There's back to your thing, would you say, see, what I understood you to say is that we moved in the course of these recent decades from known unknowns to unknown unknowns. And that is why there is a big problem. Right? 5%, 95% dark matter. So you could tackle the known unknown, howsoever poorly, but that is what theory was doing. But what do you do about it? Do you think in that context, there's room for better engagement between our philosophical systems of knowledge, ancient Indian and possibly others, and scientists. It's again nothing new, it's old hat, right from the early 20th century when quantum mechanics hit the scene. A lot of physicists were attracted towards that. Only know, remember of David Bohm from our university days, Fritz Capra and others. But is there room for, there hasn't been a real dialogue. And we are not talking about, you know, the superficial things of Vayuyan and all kinds of missiles and that thing. But the philosophical approach to knowledge. And so the language in which it discusses knowability and unknowability, for example, because you are touching on the unknowability of things. Now, science was always very bold and positive on knowability as a method. But now you are saying, if I understood you right, there is unknowability. So is there room for better dialogue on a philosophical plane, serious dialogue, between scientists who can comprehend the philosophical import? It's very abstruse, the ancient philosophical thing. I don't know if it makes sense. Or
no, it's, you know, it's a very complicated issue, the whole question of planning for the future of science in India is very complicated unless there's a drastic change in the funding by the government. This I can tell you that you have to change it by orders of magnitude to be able to compete with it. The point is this, it is still not impossible. It's a question of whether the priorities can be changed. That is my feeling. See, when we say about more funding for science, they talk about the millions who are without food, they talk about so many similar problems. You see. But that is not the solution. There are people without food everywhere. But see, that's why I told you that we have to study what the Chinese have done. They also had similar problems. And I don't know, even today, whether the living conditions in China for the normal people is the same as in other countries, or whether they are, what is the...
Okay, I think we had a very interesting session, and on behalf of every one of you, and sir, we would like to thank you for generating a lot of discussion and very important. So thank you, sir.